Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and along with Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists, it is my pleasure to introduce you to the music we'll be hearing as part of Music at Menlo's 2011 season, Through Brahms. This season, Music at Menlo illuminates the historical magnitude of the music of Johannes Brahms. Brahms represents the zenith of the Viennese classical tradition, a tradition cultivated throughout the 18th and 19th centuries by a hallowed lineage of composers, beginning with Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. Brahms's earliest works immediately drew comparisons with the greatest of his predecessors. Upon his arrival in Vienna, the musical community quickly proclaimed him the heir of Beethoven. Brahms built on the model of his forebears to create a distinct and powerful voice. He embraced centuries of tradition as a pathway to new and genuine artistic expression. Along the way, he created some of history's greatest chamber music. And in forging such a towering body of work, which no musician has since been able to ignore, Brahms has continued to inspire the most forward-looking composers of the 20th and 21st centuries. This summer features a series of six main concert programs highlighting different facets of Brahms's artistry. These are complemented by a two-concert presentation of the Brahms string quartets, the festival's Carte Blanche concert series of artist-curated recitals, and our signature encounters series, which, along with audio notes, provide thorough context to the festival's many concert offerings. We're glad to have you with us for what promises to be another exciting season at Music at Menlo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. Johannes Brahms's death in 1897 signaled the end of a musical era, one sprung from the Viennese classical tradition of Haydn and Mozart, nurtured by Beethoven, Schubert, Mendelssohn, and Schumann, and ultimately embodied by the uncompromising quality and ravishing expressivity of Brahms's finest music. At the end of his life, Brahms grew poignantly aware of his music and his era fading into history as the cultural landscape gave way to ever more radical new ideas. In the soulful timbres of the viola, clarinet, and his closest friend the piano, Brahms found a voice for the bittersweet farewell of his final works. Concert Program 6, Farewell, is bookended by two masterpieces from the last years of Brahms's life, the G major string quintet Opus 111, composed in 1890, and the clarinet quintet Opus 115, composed in the following year. Taken together, these two works illustrate an interesting turn that marked the end of Brahms's career.
It's a famous story now that after his string quintet Opus 111, he retired. He wrote a letter to his publisher that he had said everything he had to say and was going to write no longer.
Clarinetist David Schifrin.
Then, on a trip to visit friends in Meiningen, he heard and met the clarinetist Richard Mofeld. And it changed his life and brought him out of retirement. He started writing works for the clarinet. The first one was the trio, the Opus 114 that we're playing with cello and piano, and then the famous quintet, Opus 115, and then a little bit later, two sonatas that Brahms himself performed with Richard Mofeld.
The Opus 114 clarinet trio, and the first of Brahms's two clarinet sonatas, Opus 120 No. 1, appear on this summer's third Carte Blanche concert, curated by David Schifrin. The Opus 120 No. 2 Sonata, which Brahms also arranged for viola, appears on Concert Program 6.
It was a gift to all music lovers, not just clarinetists, that Brahms came out of retirement. The four works with the clarinet are each a masterpiece in their own right, but he also wrote quite a bit of beautiful piano music in this period after coming out of retirement. He wrote his four serious songs, and he wrote a whole set of organ preludes as his last work after the two clarinet sonatas. So the clarinetist Mofeld inspired a whole coda of genius from Brahms at the end of his career.
Just thinking about these two late masterpieces of Brahms, I always wish that he had written a late string quartet.
Violinist Philip Setzer.
It's a bit disappointing that he didn't. On the other hand, I see these two pieces in particular as those pieces that would represent his late string quartets, like similar to what Beethoven's late quartets are. Both of these pieces are looking ahead harmonically. There's a lot of wonderful chromaticism that you see in this. These are the early 1890s. I believe the viola quintet is 1890 and the clarinet quintet 91. So we're approaching the 20th century. And a few years later, we have Schoenberg writing für Clair zur Nacht in 1899, and then across into the 20th century, you know, basically. But you see Brahms, this classicist in a sense, in terms of the form, and somebody who's always looking back at Beethoven and also looking back at Mozart. The fact that he writes a viola quintet and a clarinet quintet certainly looks back to Mozart in a way. So he's looking backwards and forwards at the same time, and I think that's something that you see with Brahms all along. At the end here, you see him starting to look back at his life. I mean, the clarinet quintet has often been called a kind of autobiography. And there's always a nostalgia in Brahms' music, but I think in these late works, there's something even more painful and heartrending in a way, as we all do as we get older. There are more memories, and we start living more and more in those memories. And certainly the clarinet quintet, is all about that.
But the character of the viola quintet is actually quite different.
It is. I mean, it's full of energy and bright energy. I mean, the way that it opens is tremendous strength in it. It's true. It's not dealing in the subtleties that the clarinet quintet is. On the other hand, the slow movement is one of his most profound, most beautiful pieces of music that he wrote, I think. One of the most striking things about the G major viola quintet is the opening. This tremendous energy and sound of all the strings playing these slurred 16th notes, twos and twos, dee da ta da ta da ta da ta, this wonderful orchestration of it. And the cello plays this, what's basically a kind of horn solo that you might imagine from a symphony or even from a Strauss tone poem. And you need to have a very strong cellist, which we do, to sort of blast this brass solo out in the beginning. But it really sounds like Mahler or Strauss more than it does Brahms, I think, in the very beginning. So that's certainly looking ahead.
As in the previous viola quintet, the Opus 88, as well as the two string sextets, Brahms achieves a grand sonic breadth in the Opus 111 quintet by expanding on the traditional stringed quartet instrumentation. The effect of the added viola amplifies the joie de vivre that infuses the opening movement. When Brahms' friend and biographer Max Kalbeck first heard the quintet, he remarked to Brahms that it reminded him of the Prater, a beautiful public park in Vienna, to which the composer winked and replied, "You've got it, and all of the delightful girls there, too."
Well, the G major quintet, of course, has this great orchestral feel to it.
Violist Paul Neubauer.
As soon as you hear those first few bars, you think orchestra. It's da-da-da-da-da-da. Everyone just going wild there, which is so, it's radical, even though Brahms wasn't a real radical guy. It's quite radical, and it's so incredibly done. And then, of course, there are luscious melodies for the viola or violas to play together.
Brahms entrusts the movement's crooning second theme to the pair of violas. ¶¶ violins respond with another musical idea, an earnest melody marked by wide leaps. The development section begins enigmatically. Brahms recalls the shimmering string texture from the movement's opening, but this time uses it to evoke a quiet, ethereal atmosphere. Angular fragments of the main theme follow before the cello once again asserts itself with a complete melodic statement.
Beautiful melodies in this piece, and the fact that he adds the second viola, I think, gives it a richness and a darkness. Maybe he felt with the string quartet that it just, what he wanted to say needed to be expanded upon. To make the sounds with just a string quartet required a lot of double stops and wouldn't be as effective as actually adding the second viola. Slow movement begins with a gorgeous viola solo. Again, featuring the viola toward the end of his life, this is something that you definitely see. He falls in love with the viola, and he writes the two clarinet sonatas that are also played on the viola, and these two late viola quintets. The viola features prominently in the clarinet quintet as well. So there's something kind of autumnal about the sound of the viola, and certainly in this piece. The slow movement is very much that way, and it builds up to a big climax in the middle of it, and then dies away very peacefully, very beautifully. It's a sad movement, and yet there's It's not wallowing in its sadness. It's tinged with sadness, but there's something very just so beautiful about it that it makes you sad, but it makes you smile at the same time, which is some of the greatest music can do that. The third movement, a kind of scherzo movement, is interesting. This is a dance, a kind of waltz, but in very dark colors, dark hues, the way that he paints it. This is a very unusual movement, the opening of the first movement, and this way this movement is written for the strings is the most original parts, in a sense, of the whole piece. What you have here also is the way that the accompaniment is written, between the instruments, against the theme, is very interesting how he's orchestrated, the complex way that he's orchestrated the accompaniment, I think, is part of what makes it work. In the last movement, we have kind of a Hungarian gypsy-ish rondo. There's definitely some gypsy fiddling going on in this last movement.
In 1894, inspired by the clarinetist Richard Mühlfeld, Brahms composed a pair of clarinet sonatas, the Sonata in F minor, opus 120, number 1, and the Sonata in E flat major, opus 120, number 2. Though originally composed for clarinet, Brahms also sanctioned them for performance as sonatas for viola and piano.
These two sonatas that Brahms wrote were really at the end of his life, and there is a real sense of looking back. At least that's the way I interpret it.
Paul Neubauer.
And especially the E-flat sonata that we're playing. It starts off in this bittersweet, melancholy way. Da-da-dee-da-da-da-dee. I mean, there's sort of searching, yet there's a settledness to it. It's not a rambunctious Brahms that we will hear on the same program in the G major string quintet. In that very orchestral writing, the viola sonata is, I wouldn't say spare, but it is in a sense. It's just very clean. It's not, wah, it's da-dee-dum, ba-da-da-dee-dum.
As is his signature, Brahms casts the movement's melodic ideas in numerous expressive characters. Listen to this passage as the gentle opening theme becomes suddenly ill-tempered. A statement of the second theme follows, but now with a newly born anxiety, as if affected by the first theme's change in mood. After thorough exploration of the expressive potential of his themes, Brahms finishes the movement with a coda of remarkable tenderness. The viola whispers soft staccato triplet figures, like gently falling rain above quiet chords in the piano.
The dramatic second movement, it has to be this appassionato sort of feeling. That has that sort of frenzy to it, but it still has, shall we say, restraint, but that's not the best word, but there's this feeling of structure that's not going to bend too much. Very careful with the way you play Brahms. There's freedom, but if you are too free with it, you're going to lose the essence of what he's writing. That's, I think, pretty clear. When you play it, it's like, we've got to do what this person says, what Mr. Brahms wrote here, because he was so careful about it. Why else would he tear up all those pieces that he didn't want the world to see? He was careful about all this stuff.
Brahms chose to forego a slow movement in this sonata, opting instead to go right from the first movement into the energetic scherzo. The movement's central trio section, however, marked dolce e ben cantando, sweetly and very song-like, precludes any void left by the absent slow movement. The finale is a theme and variations. The idyllic theme rocks gently to and fro between the viola and piano. Five variations follow, again demonstrating both Brahms's great melodic instinct, as well as his mastery at transforming seemingly straightforward musical ideas in endlessly imaginative ways. ¶¶ The movement remains generally reserved until the fifth variation, which explodes with unexpected ferocity. The music's manic energy briefly subsides, recalling the tranquility of earlier music. But the music quickly escalates again to a brilliant finish. The late part of Brahms' career included a concentrated wave of piano miniatures composed between 1892 and 1893. A total of 20 such pieces have come down to us from these 2 years, though Brahms, who famously destroyed any work that did not completely satisfy, almost certainly composed more. The piano pieces of Brahms' opuses 118 and 119 capture the same autumnal tone of Brahms' later years as the series of clarinet works inspired by Richard Mühlfeld. The piano was Brahms' instrument, and like fellow composer-pianist Beethoven, Brahms poured into the piano some of his most deeply felt personal statements. As with Beethoven, Brahms' catalog of piano works falls neatly into distinct stylistic periods, which outline his compositional trajectory. The first group of piano works, composed throughout the 1850s and early 1860s, includes three large-scale sonatas, opuses 1, 2, and 5, the Opus 24 Handel Variations, and the Opus 35 Paganini Variations. These extremely demanding works betray Brahms as a brash young romantic, as eager to announce himself to the piano literature through them as Beethoven through his own early piano sonatas. The eight pieces Opus 76 of 1878 herald a new stage in Brahms's piano style. With this set, Brahms discovered a genre in which he would continue to feel at home throughout the rest of his career. Compact, self-sustaining miniatures, devoid of thematic connection from one to the next. The remainder of his solo piano offerings comprises similar sets to the Opus 76 pieces. The six pieces, Opus 118, and four pieces, Opus 119, illustrate the character of these latter works, subtle yet immediately emotive, and each with its distinct personality. Michael Steinberg has written of these pieces, quote, "Here, in these late musings of a keyboard master who had discovered how to speak volumes with the sparest of gestures, we find the essence of Brahms." End quote. Composed in the summer of 1893, the piano pieces of opuses 118 and 119 were sent as gifts to the aging Clara Schumann immediately upon their completion. Brahms biographer Jan Swafford has suggested that Brahms, quote, "may have composed the pieces to try and keep Clara Schumann going in body and soul. Since she could only play a few minutes at a time now, and because she loved these miniatures so deeply, maybe they did keep her alive, end quote. Swofford also surmises that the young pianist Ilona Eibenschütz, whose exquisite pianism and feminine charms enchanted the composer equally, may have inspired these lyrical, heartfelt utterances. The season closes with one of Brahms's finest works, the Opus 115 Quintet for Clarinet and Strings, composed in the spring of 1891. Like the Opus 114 Clarinet Trio and the Opus 120 Sonatas, the quintet was inspired by and composed for the clarinetist Richard Mühlfeld. Michael Steinberg has written that the clarinet quintet represents, quote, the summit of Brahms's chamber music, end quote. The quintet's forces of clarinet with string quartet create a ravishing soundscape. The work has an estimable precedent in the clarinet quintet of Mozart, composed more than a century earlier. But the texture of Brahms's quintet differs from that of Mozart's, owing primarily to each composer's respective approach to writing for the ensemble. Whereas Mozart's quintet largely resembles a clarinet concerto, with the strings often playing a supporting role, Brahms's quintet treats the clarinet as one of five equal voices.
There are a number of things that are interesting in the way that he orchestrates. In a sense, when I say orchestrate, I mean the way that he divides up the notes, who does he give what to and how.
Violinist Philip Setzer.
The clarinet quintet begins forte, but only with the two violins playing in thirds. It's a very strange marking and a very strange effect. You'd think if you were only going to have two violins starting, something like that, it would be soft. But no, he writes forte. So that's kind of strange, but also sort of takes your attention in a way that wouldn't have been the same if everybody was playing together or if it had started softly. It's a wonderful idea. And I don't know of any other piece that really does that.
The quintet shares with Brahms's other late clarinet works a particular warmth and sobriety of character. But that sobriety is exquisitely nuanced. Indeed, the expressive subtlety that colors the work throughout is part of what has made it so cherished among the chamber music literature.
You find the same kind of genius in all of these works.
Clarinetist David Schifrin.
In the quintet, there's this really bittersweet, ironic ambiguity, especially at the beginning of the entire piece, where you really don't know until quite a ways in whether you're hearing in the key of D major or in B minor, in a D major round kind of happy affirmative sound, or B minor darker, stormier. And it goes around and around until it finally comes to a cadence that is unmistakable in B minor. And throughout that work, there are these unmistakable stamps of genius.
Like so much of Brahms's music, the quintet demonstrates masterful economy of musical material to traverse broad expressive terrain. An expansion of this compact gesture from the opening measures. later blossoms into a sweeping lyrical theme sung by the clarinet. An effortless alteration of this melody closes the exposition and segues seamlessly to the development section, where Brahms fragments and further transforms the movement's thematic material. The lovely adagio answers the first movement's restlessness with a transcendent stillness reminiscent of the slow movement of Mozart's clarinet quintet. This movement also illustrates one of the key dimensions of Brahms' musical language, his lifelong fascination with gypsy music.
You know, Brahms lived in Vienna, and that's not very far from Hungary. And for him, the folk music that he loved the most was from Hungary, and the gypsy music as well. They came to Vienna and played, so he heard it there and sort of fell in love with it.
The movement's plaintive middle section features the clarinet in a semi-improvisatory Hungarian-style lament. Violist Paul Neubauer.
There's this cymbalum passage, and the cymbalum in the gypsy band is this percussion instrument. It sort of looks like a harp laid down flat. It's in a box. And when you hear a great cymbalum player, you are amazed because they're hitting it with a mallet. And some of them are going this incredible playing. And you listen to that slow movement of the Brahms, and it's and the strings are there's the cymbalum. They're obviously the cymbalum player. They're doing this background, and the clarinet is doing the tune above it. If you were to listen to gypsy music and you listen to that passage, there's no question that they are one and the same.
The third movement, Andantino, begins with an unassuming melody in the clarinet. The faster central section contrasts the character of the Andantino, but is actually a variation of the same theme. Philip Setzer.
One of the things about the clarinet quintet that is interesting, I mentioned that it is, in a sense, kind of autobiographical. He's certainly looking back at his life with great nostalgia and sadness. All of the movements of the clarinet quintet end softly. There aren't too many pieces that I know where that occurs.
The final movement begins with a melancholy theme that bears an audible resemblance to the main theme of the Andantino. A set of five variations follows, each mining further the theme's emotional depth. The first variation is dominated by the cello and amplifies the music's somber tone. In the second variation, the music becomes fleet and agitated. But Brahms's most stunning sleight of hand comes in the final variation. The variation begins innocently enough. Brahms sets a simple melody in the viola atop pizzicati in the cello. The clarinet comments eloquently. But a careful listen reveals a haunting familiarity. Not only is this music an elaboration of the theme of this final movement, but through Brahms's ineffable craftsmanship, we also realize in this fifth variation that the entire finale has sprung forth from the first movement's opening melody. Brahms takes care to make the meaning of this final variation perfectly clear by fashioning the last movement's coda around a quotation of the quintet's introduction. Michael Steinberg has written of the conclusion to the clarinet quintet that Brahms, quote, for the last time, works the miracle of showing us by imperceptible degrees how end and beginning, omega and alpha, are one, end quote.
the first movement and then the very end of the last movement, I've always felt was a kind of a depiction of a person dying, especially the very end of the piece. The last chord before the very last slow and soft chord is a kind of a surprise. It's a sudden forte. Having the clarinet playing and breathing, you get a sense of breath at the end of the first movement, and then he brings that same idea back at the end of the last movement. But instead of just ending softly as he does at the end of the first movement, he inserts this forte chord, which to me always sounds sort of like the last breath, you know, the last gasp, literally, before death. You know, not to make it overly romanticized, but it's really hard for me to imagine that he wasn't in a kind of dramatic, almost operatic sense, creating a scene of his own death.
Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following performers and organizations. Joseph Haydn's Piano Trio in G Major is performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio and appears courtesy of Menahem Pressler. Maurice Ravel's Tzigan is performed by Daniel Hope and appears courtesy of the artist. Johannes Brahms' Opus 87 Piano Trio, performed by the Florestan Trio, and Brahms' Viola Sonata in E-flat Major, Opus 120, No. 2, performed by Lawrence Power and Simon Crawford Phillips, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Johannes Brahms' Hungarian Dances, performed by Alessio Bax and Anne-Marie McDermott, The Canary and Georges Boulanger's American Vision, performed by Paul Neubauer and Wu Han, Antonin Dvorak's Slavonic Dances, performed by Wu Han and Jeremy Denk, and Johannes Brahms' Opus 111 String Quintet, performed by the Jupiter Quartet and Ida Kavafian, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Brahms' Opus 118 Intermezzi are performed by Wu Han. Brahms' Intermezzo Opus 119 No. 1 is performed by Radu Lupu and appears courtesy of Decca Records. Brahms' Clarinet Quintet is performed by David Schifrin and the Emerson String Quartet, and appears with kind permission of Deutsche Grammophon GmbH Hamburg, www.deutschegrammophon.com. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.